Sounds good. To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract from the chapter to wives, page 111. The first principle of success is that you should never be angry. Even though your husband becomes unbearable and you have to leave him temporarily, you should, if you can, go without rancor. Patience and good temper are most necessary. Our next thought is that you should never tell him what he must do about his drinking. If he gets the idea that you are a nag or a killjoy, your chance of accomplishing anything useful may be zero. He will use that as an excuse to drink more. He will tell you he is misunderstood. This may lead to lonely evenings for you. He may seek someone else to console him, not always another man. The topic of tonight's meeting is relapse, and Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, after which the floor will be open for questions rather than a typical sharing. I will now hand over to Tim. You're muted.
There we go. I'm unmuted now. So I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Just bizarre. I know not everyone in the room knows who I am. Well, I'm not really anyone. I've just been sober for 28 years. And I've been sponsoring people for 27. That's my only qualification. Just because you've done something for a long time doesn't mean you're good at it. Just you need to know that. Just means you've done a lot of it. So you maybe have more stories to tell, but I don't know if you're more effective. What to do if a sponsee relapses? I'm going to tell a lot of little sort of stories and anecdotes and ideas, which I before we even get on to what you even do once they've relapsed and come back, if they come back, is to understand the nature of the relapse. If you understand that, it just makes things so much easier. The first point may be a very obvious one, but by the time they've relapsed, it's too late. I remember I was coming back from town on a Friday evening many years ago, and I was standing at the bus stop, and a little call came through on my mobile phone from my sponsee, and she said, "It's me." And I said, "Yes." She said, "I've had a hot toddy." And I thought, well, that's very nice for you, but I don't know what to do. I can't drag it out of you. If you've had one, you've had one. They'll have to call me when it's worn off. And that started a very long relapse, actually. Then she called me a few years later and said she'd finally got a year sober, and I hope she's still sober now. But once they've had once they've drunk, it's too late. Now, when they've drunk again, it's very sort of tempting. It depends what sort you have. Sometimes you have a sponsee that drinks again and they go and live in Mozambique and then you never hear of them again. Others call you and want to talk about the fact they've relapsed as they're having, say, the hot toddy or whatever. And this is very, very inviting because you think, well, I might be able to get through to them or something. So I'm going to tell someone else's story. I'm going to tell one of the famous Clancy stories about this. And I know I've said this before, even maybe a couple of weeks ago, but it's such a good story. Who cares? So newcomer relapses and calls up Clancy and says, "I've let you down. I've let the group down. I've let AA down. And most of all, I've let myself down. Clancy, will you come over and help me?" So it's 11 o'clock at night, and Clancy says, "Well, whenever anyone anywhere reaches out the hand for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. For that, I'm responsible for it." So he goes over and he talks to him, this drunk with tears of sincerity rolling down his cheeks, until 4 a.m, and they finally get it all sorted out, and he drives home. He has 1 hour's sleep. He gets up, he has a shower, he's got to go to work in a few minutes, and there's a call. And it's this newcomer again, and the newcomer says, "Clancy, I thought you said you were going to come over." I've had conversations with people when they're relapsed, and then later that day, they literally don't know they've had the conversation with me, but they were speaking perfectly clearly at the time. I used to be a lot more of a mug with this sort of stuff than I am now. I'm wiser to it now, but I wish people well. If they've drunk, I wish people well, but there's no point in trying to carry a message. There's some various workbooks by Jim W. from San Antonio, and there's a passage which he puts in all of them, which is chilling. I'm going to read it out. "This workbook cannot help those who are active in their addictions." And this is the key line. "We don't know of any program that can help these people. Perhaps it is as simple as this. When the time comes to face the healing process, these people avoid the process via their addiction. Common sense tells us we need to totally abstain while working on this healing process. The mind that made us sick cannot make us well in its present state, nor under the influence of the addiction. We need something higher than us, different than us, other than us, which can and will do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. This is a mind training and spiritual awakening program, so it is important to be consciously present." And I think that applies not just with alcohol, but with other addictions too. So when I've tried to sponsor people in AA and their anorexia is out of control, nothing goes in. Nothing. Waste of time. You've whatever the process is, has got to be halted. Tom W. tells a story. He says, "Alcoholism is a lot like dancing with a gorilla. You're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. Except in the original story, it wasn't dancing, it was dating. Except in the original story, it wasn't dating." So if they're dancing, as it were, with the gorilla, you got to wait till the dance has stopped. There's no point trying to get in there and get between the alcoholic and the gorilla, because you'll get your arms and your legs yanked off, and not just by the gorilla. I've got to recognize my own powerlessness over their alcoholism. Another of Tom's stories is about this French-Canadian doctor in AA called Dr. Gill, who had a thick French accent. I can't do a French-Canadian accent, but I can do a French accent because I form with a French passport. And Gill would say, "Alcoholism, she has three phases. The first phase is the fun phase. That's when you're having fun. The second phase is fun plus problems. You have your first divorce, you lose your third job, but you're still having fun. The third phase, problems." And the point of this story is, whilst they're still having fun, don't interfere with it. By the time you get to people who are just in the problems phase, some people are willing. So in the big book, it talks about the well-known stages of a spree. So it's an under-discussed line, the well-known stages of a spree. Once they've gone out, you've got to wait till it runs its course. That could be a couple of hours. My friend James, who some of you know, had a bottle of wine after 8 years, and he's been, 17, 18 years sober since then. Just a bottle of wine, that was all. It lasted one night, that was it. Sometimes it takes days, weeks, months, or years to run its course, and sometimes it doesn't run its course. It's got legs again. Some other points about relapse. There's a story called The Strange, or not The Strange, Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And it's about this doctor in Scotland, I think, who takes potions to become this monstrous character called Mr. Hyde. In the book, it says to indulge unstated vices without detection. So he wants to do something and get away with it. And he takes this potion, he becomes this other character so that he himself, the doctor, is not implicated in what Mr. Hyde gets up to. So he'll take the potion and become Mr. Hyde. He'll indulge whatever vice he wants to indulge in, violence mostly. And then he'll take another potion to bring himself back to becoming Dr. Jekyll. Now, a couple of strange things happen during the course of the story. If you don't want spoilers, then, you know, go make a cup of tea right now. But during the course of the story, he starts turning into the monster without having to take the potion. Also, he needs higher and higher doses of the counter potion to bring himself back. And then eventually the counter potion to bring himself back stops working and he can't turn himself back. And that's the difficulty is people think when they go out, they I've worked with a lot of relapses over the years. They always think they can come back. I thought I could. I first came to AA in, I'd been starting drinking for 2.5 years. But I came to AA in January 1993. And back of every single relapse, I had a number of relapses between then and July 1993. Behind every single one was the thought that if things get really bad, I'll just come back. So I can handle the consequences of a slip. What harm could it do? I mean, something really dangerous might happen, but it's really unlikely. There was basically the perception that a slip is a calculated risk. And it's not. I mean, it is a calculated risk, but there's more. I might turn and not be able to get back. And my friend, I always say this, he's unfortunately, sadly, the best example. My friend Paul, in my first 2 years of recovery, we spoke for about an hour every night on the phone until around July 1995. For a few weeks, he kind of stopped calling and he drank again. And he's not, I don't think he's properly back. He's tried to come back a few times. He's got a few weeks, a few months, but it's never taken again. So we don't bring ourselves back. We have to wait till we're brought back by the process. It needs to work itself through. When I start drinking, I don't want to stop. The person I become when I go back into the drinking world has no interest in sobriety. That's why there's no such thing as a safe slip. Also, even if people can bring themselves back physically, that won't necessarily do it. There was when I was in early sobriety in Russia in 1993, I slipped and then tried to go to lots of meetings, but it wasn't taking in the same way. I found it really easy in the January, February to just not drink. Now, after a couple of slips, it was incredibly difficult. I couldn't go a couple of days. I had to stay with people to not drink physically. And then as soon as I was back in my flat, I was drinking again. So you can bring your body back to AA. It doesn't mean your mind will come back. Your mind will come back when it wants to come back. So relapse is a very, very serious thing. I think the seriousness of it can be underrated, underestimated, especially with the word slip, which makes it sound like slipping on a banana skin or something. Of course, the origin of slip is Bill W. describing someone as slipping from God's grace. Now, there are diverging views in AA on what is behind a slip. Bill, as I say, Bill W. talks about people slipping from God's grace as though it sort of happens involuntarily. In I think it's in Cleveland. I may it's either Cleveland or Akron. They had a pamphlet. This was in the 1930s, where it stated that if you slip, you have done so on purpose and you've resigned from AA. There you go. You've resigned your membership. So there were different perceptions at the time as to what was going on. My personal view is that the truth is somewhere in between, and we'll come to that. When I look back at my own relapses, there were two things going on in every single one. By the way, some people say you shouldn't really call it relapse unless you've actually fully recovered first. It's basically continuing to drink. That's really what's going on. I think that may be accurate. But every single time I resumed drinking, two things were going on. First of all, the thought of a drink occurred to me. Secondly, I acted on that drink, on that thought of a drink, because it was my thought. I was still in charge. I still saw myself as the captain of my own ship. Now, I can't control what thoughts come into my mind. So the only solution, if you have a mind which wants to drink, is to surrender your decision-making process, literally about what to do with your day, to a higher power. I can't retain any agency myself, or I'm stuffed. As soon as the thought of a drink occurs to me, if I'm in charge, I'll drink. What's her name? Grady O.H. says that she hears people saying, today I have a choice and today I choose not to drink. And she says, well, thank God I don't have a choice, because some days I would choose to drink. That's why I need not to be in charge. That's why I need my higher power to be in charge, because my higher power isn't thirsty. Whenever I drank again, I was always still in charge, which means that I needed to surrender. And how do you surrender? It was basically surrendering to the actions of the program today, each day, so that my day, from the moment my weary eyes creaked open in the morning until they snapped shut at night, the day was not my own. That was how I treated it. I the day was too dangerous to have in my hands because of what I would do with it. I was on a very, very short leash when I got sober. I was a very slippery customer. So what it meant was taking the actions of the program, regardless of what I thought or felt about the actions. It's impossible. You can't hand over to God very easily when you're very new. You have, my experience, you have to hand over to the actions of the program, because that's something concrete. That's something you can see people doing. You can follow someone else's instructions because you can see them physically in front of you. Much easier to do that than to follow what you think God is asking you to do. Later on, there comes a crunch point where it's between you. It's like you're in a boxing ring. And there's you in one corner and the desire to drink in the other. And you know that you're going to get knocked out by it. And the only thing standing between you and the drink is the higher power, because other people are just not powerful enough anymore. So there came a crunch point for me in 1993, where I had to say to this higher power, I cried out to it, really. What the words I said didn't matter. I, at some psychological level, I threw myself at the mercy of this higher power, recognizing I would drink otherwise, and said, whatever you need to do, do it. And I was fine that night. I didn't drink. And that was from a point that I knew that I would. So ultimately, it's between, although it's all about the program of action, behind that, there's the safety net is throwing yourself at the mercy of God in the moment. And a sponsor of mine who was relapsing once phoned my sponsor, my sponsor, and said, well, when I feel like drinking, what do I do? Do I do my step four? Do I pray? Do I meditate? He said, it doesn't actually matter what you do, as long as you do what you believe to be your higher power's will. And if you have to lie screaming on the floor until the pain of not doing what you want to do passes, do that. Kind of doesn't matter. The only, you have to be able to get through one day not doing the thing that you want to do. And this is in the big book itself, in the Alcoholic Anonymous number 3 story, where they say to him, you can stay sober for 24 hours, can't you? And he says, yeah, anyone can stay sober for 24 hours. I can, as long as I've thrown away the right to choose whether or not I'm going to drink and simply surrender myself to sobriety and commit to sobriety. And so I'm just going to have to put up with being sober, whether I like it or not, just for today. And that was when the relapsing stopped. The causes of relapse. When a sponsee does come back, I pretty much always run through there's a pretty standard list of possible causes. We run through the possible causes to try to identify what's going wrong. And here they are. The first one is step zero, which is the, as it were, the step before the steps. And this was my problem for a while. I wanted to stop drinking forever, but not just yet. To get sober, I've got to want to get sober forever and forever to start now. So while I still wanted to drink at some level, nothing was going to happen. There are step one reservations, particularly about the physical craving. There are two sides to a reservation about the physical craving. I believed that I could have what I called a controlled outbreak, in that I could go and blow away the cobwebs without too many serious things happening. And of course you can't, that's the whole point of the physical craving. You can't predict at the beginning of the drinking bout whether nothing is going to happen, or whether you're going to get run over or arrested or whatever. And it was like Russian roulette. The other one we've covered already is the belief that I can toy with my alcoholism and come back. There are step two reservations, which I suppose are step one, step two reservations about believing that I can stay sober without a spiritual awakening, that the knowledge of AA and a few of the AA actions will be sufficient to keep me sober. Believing that I can just take AA at my own pace, you know, progress, not perfection, easy does it. It's amazing the slogans you can find to support that approach. And sometimes people would say it's not a race. And I think it is absolutely a race. Now, it's not a race against Janet and Susan. It's a race against one's own alcoholism, which, as they say, is doing press-ups in the car park outside. I think the game is to have a spiritual awakening more quickly than the alcoholic ego grows back. I think that's the deal. And there's... Now, a lot of people, the difficulty is that AA meetings and fellowship are very effective at keeping people sober for a while. And it gives everyone the impression that they can keep people sober indefinitely. But of course, that's not the case. If you hang around AA for a long time, you'll discover that's not the case. That the grace period, the grace period we get obviously we ha- there is a grace period, because if there weren't, how would you get to the spiritual awakening in step 12 to keep you sober if you didn't have grace to get there? It's like you've got to get a free pass to get to step 12. Now, how much of a free pass you get seems to vary from person to person. It's impossible to tell until it's too late. So you have to treat yourself like you're on a short leash, because you just don't know. You just don't know. So there are reservations about, you know, how fully do I have to give myself to the AA program to guarantee sobriety? And then there are some step three conditions, which I think stop people from giving in to the notion of sobriety fully. And you can help tease these out with people by saying, finish this sentence for me. I believe sobriety is not worth it if X happens. What's X? What are the events that you think, well, if that happens, it's not worth staying sober? Or conversely, I believe sobriety is not worth it if X doesn't happen. What ambitions or goals or demands do you have? Where if they're not met, it's not worth staying sober. So the bad events you want to avoid, and the good events which you think, oh, I have to have that to be happy. Because I had this, I had very specific demands about finance and success in the external world. And as soon as things looked as though they weren't going my way, I thought, what's the point in being sober? And I'd be drunk again. I had to get to a position where I was willing to stay sober, even if lots of terrible things happened, and even if none of the good things I wanted happened. So the conditions had to go. So this is what I do. I review with people when they do come back from a slip, possible causes. Is it step zero? Is it step one? Is it step two? Is it step three? In almost every case, the actual effort with the program has been half-hearted. Often it starts well, but then dwindles in the days or weeks before the slip, and then boom, they're drunk. Very, very occasionally, you have someone that is working terribly hard at the program, but slips anyway. It's exceptionally rare in my experience, and almost always there's a nasty little secret, or there's another addiction which people are acting out on. And my sponsor, when I was acting out, said, beware of your own orthodoxy. The reason you're being such a good little AA boy in all these areas over here is to hide the fact you're doing X, Y, and Z over there. So sometimes, like, the super diligent sponsees who are doing absolutely everything, you know, tickety-boo, straight away, there's something being hidden somewhere, because that's where the energy is coming from to be so perfect on the surface. So, but that's rare. It's really rare. In almost every case, there's half measures going on. The only answer is to offer someone the full program, to set out the facts, which are very basically that only full measures, in my experience, guarantees sobriety. And what does full measures mean? It means hammering the first nine steps and hammering the last three steps. Now, sometimes, when there's a lot of relapse history, there's a funny phenomenon. This is going to sound like I'm being completely mad, but I think this is a genuine thing. Doing the steps to avoid doing the steps. And this is where people will engage in the process of the first nine steps again and again and again, in order to avoid actually changing anything. So there's lots of time spent reading and writing and talking and analyzing and sharing all the defects and doing page after page of inventory, but the person won't get up in the morning. They won't make their bed. They won't stop stealing. They won't stop lying. They won't show up at work. Do you know what I mean? And I've been guilty of this without drinking, of doing lots of formal step work, but without any real effort to change the things that need to change. So sometimes you have to come at this, if that's the history, when people know the big book backwards, you have to come at it differently, look at the daily program first, and get steps 10, 11, and 12 in place. These are people who've been through the steps before, but have relapsed and have got a good understanding of the program in principle. The problem is often not that they don't have a handle on the character defects. The problem is that there is ongoing current harm to people in their lives. And that's why the focus can sometimes be best on steps 10, 11, and 12. But ultimately, in my experience, the thing which guarantees sobriety is willingness and sincerity. It's not about the exact mechanics of what you give them to do. Something my sponsor said once, it doesn't matter what you give them to do, as long as you give them something to do and they do it. That if, sometimes people say, well, if my sponsor had asked me to, stand on my head on Oxford Street, I would have done it. Of course, no sponsor has ever asked anyone to do that. But I have a feeling if someone thought that that was what would keep them sober, it would. It's the act of surrender to the action which seems to make the difference. My first run through the steps was, between you and me, embarrassing. I wouldn't give you tuppence for how I worked the steps in the first year. Technically, it was a complete disaster, but I did it sincerely and I stayed sober. And the main boxes were ticked, the secrets were conveyed. I made some terrible amends, but I made them. They were accepted. I started to take action. This is the key thing. I started to take actions to get my life in order under the direction of the sensible people around me. A couple of patterns to watch out for. There's one pattern which you could call good dog, bad dog. So when the sponsee comes back, lots of remorse from the drinking, hugely sincere immediately after the slip, initially very high levels of compliance, like almost going above and beyond, but then it dwindles and then they disappear and then they relapse and then they rinse and repeat. And this goes round and round and round. What's usually going on here? When I've talked to people who've got this cycle, because this was my cycle actually, good dog, bad dog. There was one chap I used to talk to a lot and try and help. I don't know how much it helped, but kept me sober. Well, I'd say what happened before the slip in the few days. So my head told me this, my head was telling me that, my head, my head, my head, my head. And it struck me as really interesting, this, because I thought, well, this is the root of the problem. Because when I look back at my own relationship with my head or my, toxic thoughts, have you heard people in meetings laughing about, oh, my, on the way to the meeting, my head was telling me this, Y, and Z, ha, and everyone laughs about, what their head was telling them. Now that's the right attitude, because you're treating your head, which is the alcoholism or the disease, as some like crazy goblin in the corner, some kind of vampire gerbil in its little wheel going round and round and round with its fangs, but having no power, there's no substance to it. It's just rubbish, just rubbish. Whereas this chap, he was mesmerized by it. My head was telling me this, my head was telling me that. And I said to him, do you think your head is your higher power? And he said, yes. There you go. So when his head would tell him to go to AA, he'd go to AA. And when his head would tell him to drink, he'd drink. So the reason this is important is because with this kind of pattern, which I've called good dog, bad dog, it looks like someone is doing what you're asking them, but they're not. They're doing what they have judged. You've suggested something, they've judged it to be the right thing. So they're doing it because they judge it to be the right thing, not because you've suggested it. Whereas the ideal thing with a sponsor I've found is to do what my sponsor suggests, not because I think it's a good idea, but because he suggested it and I trust him. And Clancy's description of sponsorship is, one of his descriptions is to take actions you don't believe in because the person who's suggesting them is doing better than you. the other pattern, I'm going to finish fairly shortly, I think, is what we might call pseudo-surrender. And this is where people are very good at some things, but not good at others. I've talked about this a little bit already. Overcompensating in some areas. So my friend Sarah, who is now a clinical psychologist at one of the big teaching hospitals in London, but she was she got sober, same age as me, same year. She used to wake up covered in cold pasta. That was one of her drinking stories. Naked, covered in cold pasta. What a sight that must have been. Anyway, she's a clinical psychologist now. But she was good at talking and analysing. This is her own story. She doesn't mind me telling this. She was good at talking and analysing, but she wasn't very good at leaving the house. And she phoned Janet. Janet was Sarah's sponsor. And she phoned Janet one day. Janet, I'm too frightened to leave the house. Then she reeled off all the diagnoses for why she was too frightened to leave the house. Like sort of scouts badges. It's not that they're not real. I mean, you know, anxiety is anxiety. But the question is, how are we going to treat it? And what Janet suggested, now I'm not condoning this, I'm just reporting what happened. Janet said, I'll only talk to you if you call me from the phone box at the end of the road. And I'll know because it'll be a different number than the number you're currently calling on. And I can see the number you're currently calling on. She put the phone down. Sarah called her back from the home number and Janet said, that's your home number. Click. So Sarah got up the courage, took a while, got up the courage and called from the phone box at the end of the road, panting, panicking, but she did it. She did the one thing she didn't want to do. She trusted Janet and she wanted to talk to Janet. And Janet said, how was it? And Sarah said, it wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be. And Janet said, you've learned a very valuable lesson about fear there, haven't you? The story in the big book about precisely that, about walking around the block. So the point of that story is sometimes the sticking point is the action that the person absolutely doesn't want to take. And once that action starts being taken, the whole thing starts to roll. And progress starts being made. So with this sort of pseudo surrender, where like people are super surrendered in areas A, B and C, but not in areas D, E and F, to bear down hard on areas D, E and F, because that's where the problem is. The good, the compliance on the other side is the distraction. That was what was done with me. I got lots of stories myself about the sponsor zoning in on the last thing I want to do, making it my number one priority. And that's been incredibly important for my recovery. And that the reason this is related to relapse is the ability to do the last thing that you want to do because someone else has asked you to do it. Someone you trust has said this is going to be in your best interests. That's ultimately the thing. That muscle is the muscle that you need to exercise to be able to not do what your alcoholic head is telling you to do. And that's why it's so important to start learning how to act against one's own impulses. So there we go. That's all I've got on that. I'm going to hand it back to you, Dan, masquerading as Alistair this evening, to see if we can field some questions.
Okay, thanks, Tim. The meeting is now open for questions for Tim, which can be done by the raised hand function, or just give me a wave and come in and ask Tim. Sam, come in.
Cheers, Dan. Sam, nobody. Thanks, Tim. That was really helpful. Does any of what you said change when you apply it to different addictions like sex and love?
You're muted.
There we go. Okay, so for the backup recording, I'm repeating the question for the sake of the recording. So does everything apply also to the other addictions? Let me see, there's a note I need to read. I don't know where he's put it now. Okay. So my relevant experience is particularly with the SLA topics. I know a lot less about food, but I've got SLA issues myself, and I've worked with a lot of people over the years. And there are differing views on this. So be aware that there are differing approaches. I've seen people with the S stuff, with the SLA stuff, try really, really hard, and the abstinence is not achieved 100% straight away. And lots of my friends, I've known a lot of people in the food fellowships who say a similar thing, that with some people, they start taking all the action promptly, and the food stuff clears up straight away. Other people, it's patient progress over weeks or months before full abstinence is fully maintained. The latter is the case for me with the SLA issues, that it was patient progress, even with like full throttle action. I found myself slipperier than other people. But I know there are other, I don't sort of out people in this room. I know there are other people in this room who've got more extensive experience on the S stuff than me. But I think the same general principles certainly for me, the same general principles apply when it comes to the reasons for relapse. It's all the same reservations behind it.
Thank you.
Angus. Hi, thanks. Thanks, Tim. I'm working with someone who is slipping a lot. And I guess you've kind of talked about it, but I guess how would you approach a situation where I say, you know, at some point you need to be willing not to slip or willing to stay sober. I mean, I can't give you that. He says, but I'm powerless. I'm powerless. You know, what can I do? I'm a little bit stumped. I guess it's kind of understanding what are the kind of the drivers in terms of the step 0, 1, 2, and 3. But how would you approach a kind of conversation like that?
Okay, so that's a very good question. So this question of powerlessness over the relapse, the line, which I think is very helpful, is that we're powerless but not helpless. And so there isn't a contradiction there. What powerlessness means is that left to my own devices, I have no choice but to drink or engage in whatever the behavior is. The whole point of AA is that your powerlessness remains, as it were, a sort of permanent state. But with the help that's provided, it's sort of placed in this structure of assistance, of the program, the principles, the power behind it, i.e. the higher power, and then the people, the four P's. And with the combination of the entire fellowship, the program, the principles, and God, anything should be possible. So there's a little bit of a danger of hiding behind the powerlessness of step one. The examination of powerlessness takes place in a context where there is no help available. That's what demonstrates the powerlessness. With my own, there are a couple of other points I want to make about slippiness with the SLA stuff, because it is the one of the reasons it's slightly different. In my view, this is very much a personal view. I may change my mind even later tonight. But the effect of the chemical and electrical effect in the brain of a fantasy which flits through your mind, or if you're walking along the street and you're, as it were, triggered by someone looking at you in a particular way, the chemical rush is almost as though you're creating the slip itself inside your, with your own brain chemistry. Now, with alcohol and cocaine is a good example, actually, that they, Nora Volkoff, you can look her up later with a V, I think, Nora Volkoff, Mexican neuroscientist. She talks about experiments where they showed cocaine addicts film footage of people taking cocaine in a kind of cocaine taking environment, and they measure the brain waves, what's going on in the brain. And then they did the same with cocaine addicts taking cocaine, and they discovered almost no difference in the brain function between the two, so that watching the film of people taking cocaine was causing the same changes in brain chemistry that taking cocaine was doing. Which is a little bit like the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde being able to turn into Mr. Hyde without taking the potion. Now, with alcohol, I think a lot of the slips that I had started off with the fantasy about it, and it starts in the brain and you're kind of setting yourself off. My experience with the SLA stuff is it was far more instantaneous than it was with alcohol. You kind of had to work at it with alcohol, but with the SLA stuff, boy, was it quick. But here's the thing. I think I always set myself up by never having fully accepted the valuelessness of the acting out. There was still part of me which still believed there was some value in the acting out, that I was missing out on something. And that's the thing that I was able to actively work on, is to get rid of the notion that I was, by abstaining from X, Y, and Z, everyone's little list is different in SLA, abstaining from X, Y, and Z, that getting rid of the idea that I was actually missing out on something. And this applies as much to the intrigue, the flirting, the sort of toxic romantic relationships as it does to sex. It was and it was in fact the latter which was more my downfall. But I had to really see that there was nothing, that there was no good at the bottom of the genie's flask. There was nothing there. Whilst I still believed there was some good in there, I was opening myself up to those fantasies, and then I was opening myself up to relapse. So now the thing is, one's got to be sort of gentle with people. I think particularly with the SLA stuff, I've seen people actually in much more baffled desperation with the SLA stuff than I have even with alcohol. Because people can't work out, they can't find the reservation. And so I try and be as sort of slow and gentle with people as possible about helping them find what the reservation is. With the alcoholics, the reservation is, it's not buried deep. It's just definitely like drinking and that's it. or there's some event they can't, some event from the past that they can't bear to face. So I did, Angus, does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Laura, come in.
Okay, thanks. I have a question with the good dog, bad dog behavior, but not in terms of the substance, but actually in terms of working, like doing the step work and what your experience is like when people like sort of have that, like they're doing everything you say, but then you don't hear from them, or they like, so it's like this cycle of, but not with actually relapsing, but just with not being engaged. And I'm wondering if the questions that you pose, like, it's not worth staying sober if X doesn't happen, or it's not worth staying sober if X does happen. It's sort of like, it's not worth being by doing full measures if X doesn't happen, or it's like not worth doing full measures if X does happen, right? Like, can you use the same criteria? Is that a question? Is that a clear question?
I think so. So I think there's actually a slightly broader question, which is how you deal with that cycle. One thing that I do with people who have a history of being terribly good for a while and then gradually going off the boil and then disappearing is insisting on daily contact before 9 a.m. in the morning. That works pretty well. And what happens is you'll hear, if you need to listen very, very carefully, you'll hear stuff in their voice. You'll hear a change in the voice, a change in the tone. And you'll say, hey, what's that about? You seem pretty keen to get off the phone today. What are you frightened of today? What's bothering you? And very often they'll reveal something which they wouldn't otherwise have revealed. And then the next day they're fine again. So I think it's, if you stay close to them, you can often spot something before they know it's going on. Now it's not foolproof. And ultimately you have to remember it's down to the individual. You know, Maureen's great sort of, rule of thumb that if they don't want it, you can't say anything, right. And if they do want it, you can't say anything wrong. So, But on the margins, I think how we do sponsor people does matter. Otherwise, we wouldn't be sitting here today. I think we have a duty to do our absolute best, but it's ultimately down to them. What's often going on, this is with the kind of good dog, bad dog thing, is their higher self knows that they ought to stay sober. But their lower self doesn't yet want to. And there's a fight between the two. And at one point in the cycle, it's like, you know, the weather device where when it's those old barometers where when the weather was fine and the mercury was high, the sunny person would come out and then it would, when the pressure dropped, the mercury would drop and it would twist round, and then the rainy person would come out. And that's what you've got, is you've got the two sides, and the two have to be integrated somehow. And one way of doing it to integrate those two sides is to say, right, those are two voices. There's a voice for your higher self, which wants you to get well, which wants you to have a life, which wants you to succeed in the world. There's another part which is just wants to get loaded and just wants to do X, Y, and Z. Let's not spell it out. Now, you aren't either of those things. You're the person that gets to pick between those two things. And so your job is to pick which one of those you want to run with. Whichever one you pick, you're giving your full force to. Have you ever noticed with sponsees, sometimes you're talking to a sponsee and it's like they've taken the side of the disease, they've taken the side of the alcoholism, they've taken the side of the ego, and you're now in a boxing match and they're fighting the corner of their ego or their disease or their alcoholism. And you realize you're not talking to them anymore. You're talking to the ego, the disease or the alcoholism, and they're throwing the full force of everything they know about the program to fight against the program. And there's the way round that. You see, the problem is when people flip back and forth thinking that those two voices, that either of them are who they are, and they're not. Those two voices are simply ways of looking at the world, the right mind and the wrong mind, but they're not either. And the trick you can say to someone in that moment, hey, have you noticed that you've just taken the side of your ego? Now, I want to ask you, do you really want to do that? How about you side with me against your ego and let's see if we can't make... Do you think it might be more in your interests to side with me against your ego than to side with your ego against the whole of AA? Which do you think would be more in your interests? And it gets people to separate themselves from the voice and work out which voice they really want to listen to. And then I've actually, I've heard my sponsor on the phone to someone, I'll finish in a second because it's almost eight. I've heard my sponsor on the phone to someone saying, this is when I was in the car with him in Texas. I get sort of get trained on how to sponsor because all these calls, the calls are constantly coming in. And he lets them know that I'm there and they don't mind. And I've heard him saying to people, and now we've heard enough from your ego, I'm addressing Andrew's ego right now. Andrew's ego, I'd like you to step aside and let me speak to Andrew for a moment. Now, Andrew, what do you think about this? He literally separates out the ego within the person from the person and asks to speak to the person. And it's pure AA, this. It's when people say in AA, the disease is telling me to drink, but I know my higher power wants me in here. It's where you identify as something beyond the ego, beyond the disease, beyond the addiction, that gets to choose which voice is it in my best interests to listen to. And that's how you can get people out of that good dog, bad dog thing. That's all I've got on that. Over to you, Dan, I think.
Hi, thanks everybody for the questions and thanks for Tim. For the topic tonight, can you help me close the meeting using the Serenity Prayer?
God.
Trinity. Accept the things I cannot change.
Courage to change the things I can.
The wisdom
to know the difference.